This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse, or you can call us 860-275-7266. Today, we're on Facebook Live. You can find us again on the WNPR Facebook page. And we're also with CTN. The Connecticut Network is here. So thanks to them for coming in. I want to welcome in our panelists. As always, Colin McEnroe is here. He's the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Kalila Brown-Dean is here as well. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Hello there, Kalila.
Hi, John.
And Keith Vanoff is here. He's our state budget reporter, our state budget guru from the Connecticut Mirror. Hello there, Keith.
Good morning.
I'm trying out a new voice today for the holidays, so we'll see how this goes. And we're actually going to start with something that Keith has not just been writing about this week, but been writing about for quite some time, about the staggering income inequality in our state, some of the things that go into that income inequality. Perhaps we'll be talking throughout the course of this hour about ways in which we can get out of it. Among the studies you cite is one by the Economic Policy Institute, which finds the top 1% of households in Connecticut, on average, came out of the last recession earning more than 42 times the average of the other 99%. So nationally, that's about 25 times as much. So that gap, Keith, let's just start there. In Connecticut, there's a perception that it's much bigger between the haves and the have-somes and the have-nots.
Sure.
But it actually statistically is much bigger than the rest of the country.
It is. And if you really want to refine it, John, in Fairfield County, it's 74-1. And I think what's important, too, is we're not talking about the difference between the uber-wealthy and the folks who may be working at a fast food restaurant or in a convenience store. We're talking about comparing the salaries of the top 1%, or I should say the earnings of the top 1%, with the bottom 99%. There are some ridiculously rich people in the bottom 99%. It's what they're averaging. That's the gap. And this, by the way, is a larger gap than we've seen since before the stock market crash of 1929.
So the gap is enormous, and we've seen this for, well, as long as I've been here in Connecticut and covering it. What is it about right now that's causing the gap to be so big, specifically coming out of the last recession, the economic downturn of 2008?
I mean, there are a lot of forces. What I try to think of is, again, probably from the late 1920s until about 1980, we were moving as a nation toward greater wealth equality. We had a lot of forces that were pushing us there, from post-war prosperity to gains in civil rights, the increase in collective bargaining. The access to higher education expanded significantly after World War II. And then starting with the election of President Reagan, not saying that was the only turning point, but around that time, we started to move in the other direction. We've had a lot more globalization of the economy. We have a lot more technology replacing simple jobs. One of the things that we're finding, though, is since the last recession, we've not only reversed all the gains, but we've now moved into new uncharted territories of inequality. And the danger, the biggest thing, I guess, to take away from it is nobody's saying the only way the economy is safe is socialism. But economists across the political spectrum, from the most conservative to the most liberal, agree there is a danger point, a tipping point, when you have too many people, too large of your economy that doesn't contribute to the GDP, that can't afford to properly take care of themselves, house themselves, get health care. In other words, they're drawing on government services, not contributing toward the prosperity. Your entire economy is at risk.
And the last thing before I turn to the other panelists, because there's a lot to unpack here, and there's a lot more in your other story about those millionaires and whether or not we could or should be taxing them more. But what specifically is it in Connecticut? You're talking about national trends. As a nation, we sort of turned our back on the idea that we were going to get toward wealth equality over the course of the last couple decades. Connecticut obviously has a lot of high-income earners. It always has. But is there something specific about Connecticut or Connecticut policy that has exacerbated this gigantic gap?
I think we live in ground zero for income and wealth inequality on planet Earth. A lot of people don't realize it. And the dangerous perception is we always thought, well, that's just the really wealthy hedge fund earner outdistancing a very prosperous middle class and, quite frankly, a not that poor off lower class, lower income class. That's not the case anymore. Since the last recession, nationally, the top 1% have captured about 85% of the income growth. In Connecticut, it's 100%. Everyone else has been losing ground, about 2% on average. since the last recession. So you have a large group of people who are moving, slipping into that dangerous poverty gap where they're not contributing.
Yeah, and I think it's important for us to tease out the difference between the income gap and the wealth gap, because people in our state always point out to a few individuals who seem to be doing quite well or have high salaries. But that's not wealth. That's sort of generational transfer. And what it means, not just in terms of financial income, but also the ability to tie into networks. Our state has an opportunity gap, so that you have a lot of people who would consider themselves middle class but don't have access to the kind of networks in education, in job opportunities and civic opportunities that allow them to do even more, to be entrepreneurs and grow their space. That's the generational piece that I think we often miss in the conversation. What are the opportunities for young people in our state to do well and to stay here?
And you cover national politics as well. So is there something in your mind, Kalila, that's specific to Connecticut about the way in which we address or don't address that issue that makes it worse here?
I think that we are a state that is highly residentially segregated, and that makes a difference. So whether we're talking about, you know, property taxes and how that gets distributed, the opportunities that it has, when we look at the lack of development and affordable housing, the lack of growing our economy, so not just the sort of, you know, high intellectual capacity jobs, but the disappearance of those kind of manufacturing sectors that allowed people to become solidly middle class in the past and create opportunities for their kids.
Colin?
So first of all, I want to say that Keith's two articles are really, really good, and they're long, and you should read them both. And we're not going to be able to cover everything in them now. We could take little kind of nibbles out of all this stuff, so I'll take a little nibble. I was thinking about this morning, and I was thinking about a guy that I know who I didn't even realize until recently. He actually does officially live in Florida. He's a very wealthy guy, very nice guy, from Connecticut, made his money in Connecticut, cares about Connecticut. But it turns out probably his guy told him, you know, 183 days in Florida, you're just going to be a little bit better off. So I was thinking about, let's call this guy Ernie. Like, what would it take? You know, what would it take to get Ernie to, quote unquote, live in Connecticut again? And one thing that intrigues me anyway is that Ned Lamont is the first governor we've had since Weicker who actually is from this world. He's from the world of the people that Keith is talking about. He's from that upper echelon. And so presumably he knows a lot of them. He speaks their language. He knows a little bit about how they think. And one thing that just occurred to me, and I thought about this morning. I don't know how good an idea it is, but it strikes me that, you know, we can't fix the problem that Kalila and Keith are talking about at a Connecticut level very easily, as long as there's 49 other places to go to. And as was pointed out in Keith's article, as long as you can drive, you know, 100 miles and be in a different place, you know, it's very, very hard to fix this in a state. What can you do in a state about the inequality that we're talking about that doesn't drive the rich people someplace else? And one thing that rich people do like to do, I think you have to find things they like to do. Well, they like to be philanthropists. They really like to be philanthropists. They don't like paying taxes very much, but they like to be philanthropists. And I wonder if you could start there, if Ned Lamont and Melissa McCaw, his new budget director, could start there and start a dialogue up with some of the people who have moved but still are basically here in the state and people who are at risk of moving and moving their large fortune someplace else and say, how could we structure taxes, how could we structure your liabilities so that, like, what if we did drop the top rate down the way the Doomsday Panel talked about doing? What if we dropped it down, but you made a commitment to start funding some of the nonprofits that are, in fact, as we'll be getting to later in the show, you know, going to have to pick up some of the slack of what state government does, deliver services, create educational and economic opportunities for people down near the bottom of the ladder? What if we created some kind of system where it could be more attractive for you to be a taxpayer here in Connecticut, but the backside of that is you'd be an even bigger philanthropist than you are now. And, you know, we put your name on stuff because they really like that.
Keith, what do you think of Colin's idea?
Unfortunately, it's moot because Connecticut doesn't have the fiscal flexibility to do that. And this goes back to the other thing we've talked about forever. It's like, it's tough enough to say, what are solutions to income and wealth inequality? And Colin raised a very cogent point. But we're also dealing with our legacy of debt, our pension debt. We have a bill collector coming at the door every year demanding more money to catch up on these benefit payments that we never saved for. So we don't have the luxury of forget lowering taxes, even freezing our tax rate, because the business community will say, well, if we just kept taxes constant for 5 or 10 years, the economy would take off. But what do you do when every single year the bill collector is at the door saying, you have to pay more in teachers' pensions, you have to pay more in state employees' pensions, I'm not going to wait for these other things. It's kind of like trying to fix the roof while it's raining outside. We're caught with two massive problems, both threatening us, both demanding attention, and either one would take up all of our time.
All of our time and Colin, all of our money. The idea that is sort of laid out in Keith's stories is that without some sort of additional tax revenue, we don't even get close to, maybe even at that point, don't get close to touching any of the systemic problems. So the thing that you're talking about that might help to solve some of the issues, it won't ever get there because we won't be able to use people's money and give them tax breaks to help to fund nonprofits, because we're going to have to use that money just to help pay down the bills.
Right. And that is... that's tragic and that's a problem, but I still, I'm not taking this morning's idea off the table yet. I think there may be ways to do it. I think a lot of it also probably involves having a dialogue between Melissa McCaw and her troops and the guys, who are some of whom are women, I would say, who tell these rich people where to go. You know, go to Florida. You know, don't do this anymore. So, because I think a lot of these wealthy people, they don't go because they decided. They go because for 6 years in a row, the people who handle their taxes and their finances, you're crazy. You got to get out of here. And they get tired of hearing it. And so they live for 183 days someplace else. I'm just interested in knowing if there's a way to keep the money in the state. But let me say one other thing about Keith's article, because it has something in it that I keep coming back to. It's at the end of the millionaire with a suitcase article, I think. And I think Fred Carstensen is the one talking about it. Maybe not. But okay, so the Doomsday Panel, that's the Commission on Financial Stability and Donuts and Bowling, or whatever it's called. You know, they cited a number, I think, at that time for what are the for the total number of exemptions in the state budget. So let's define exemptions as situations in which an entity or person would ordinarily have to pay a certain amount of money in taxes, a certain kind of tax, but for whatever reason doesn't pay those taxes. I think their number was $5 billion. Keith's got $6.5 billion at the end of it. So there's $6.5 billion in theoretical putative tax obligations that just don't get paid, often because some lobbyist very effectively got in there and said, yeah, well, for these people, you know, we really can't have them pay that because the business will move out of the state or whatever. Somebody got them a deal, you know, or this was seen as a net positive. One place I would start in the revenue picture is a really rigorous examination of that $6.5 billion in tax obligations that, for whatever reason, don't have to be met.
I think, Colin, you shouldn't take the suggestion off the table because it's already happening in pockets. So if we look at the role of community foundations across our state, I know in Greater New Haven we're talking about this notion of inclusive growth, that it can't just be about New Haven and the neighboring towns. It has to be a regional approach. Because I think the question that was raised earlier, can we afford to do this? Can we afford not to do it? What are the consequences of that? And so whether people have portable wealth and decide to go somewhere else, who gets left behind and what gets left behind, I think has to be a part of the conversation.
Just to take one more stab at it, I want to go back to one of Kalilah's points, and it was very important. You know, the difference between income and wealth inequality. Income is pretty self-explanatory, but your wealth is not only talking about your savings, or people think about the stocks or the bonds or the value of your home. It's also your negatives. It's your credit card debt. It's your mortgage. It's your student loan debt. And these are things, it could be your healthcare debt because you couldn't pay your bill at the hospital. These are things that are really wearing down the poor and the middle class. Okay. Think about, as she then said, the struggles they're having accessing higher education, accessing quality healthcare because of this disparity. Now let's go back and look at this pension debt. What the state budget's pension debt is doing is it's leeching resources already out of the services designed to help these folks. It's making it harder for people to get on the Husky plan. It's making it harder for people to afford a community college or a state college education. So if we want to, and again, Colin's idea is brilliant, but it's like trying to spread a tablecloth that's too small over a large table. No matter how you tug it, you're exposing another area. So if we were to say freeze, forget cutting taxes on the rich, freeze taxes on the rich in the hopes of producing more philanthropy. The only way to do that, because the pension bill is going up, mm-hmm. is to pull more money out of the community college system, put more working poor people off of health insurance and into the ranks of the uninsured, and then it costs you in the long run. It really is a situation where we're caught in so many places, and because we've allowed too many problems to accumulate at once, ideas that make perfect sense, we don't have the luxury because literally the bill collector won't leave us alone long enough to put these ideas in play.
I want to get back to something else, though, Kalila. It's sort of a big idea that's at the heart of all this, which is, you know, Keith's article talks about the gigantic income inequality gap. But the other piece, you know, this myth, perhaps, or maybe the reality of people leaving the state, high income earners can't put up with the taxes anymore. So to Colin's point, we want to keep high income earners here. And we want to do whatever we can to keep businesses, high income earners, so that they'll continue to contribute to the tax base. But if we don't have the ability to actually provide services for people at the lower end of the spectrum, there's no way that that gap is going to close. Let's say we're able to keep high income earners here. I can't imagine that the gap somehow gets smaller when we have more billionaires living here through whatever tax means we have. I guess I'm not sure exactly how we pull ourselves out of this without some gigantic structural reform that I don't know if this governor or any other governor would be able to take on.
So I think the fundamental flaw in the premise is that we have a collective commitment to addressing the gap. There are many people who benefit from this gap, and they are often people in positions of power, positions of influence, whether elected or not, who can either exploit that gap for their personal gain or who like to believe that poverty is somehow a moral indictment, not just in our state, but in our country. And so exploiting that, if people are rich and wealthy, it must be because they have lived so well, as opposed to inheriting wealth or having their father be able to give them $1 million to start a business. Must be nice. I didn't inherit that. So that kind of hearts and minds approach coupled with the structural reform. So yes, we have a lot of people who make a lot of money, who have a lot of wealth, but are they contributing at the same rate as those who do not? And that's not the case. And so looking in that way, it will be unpopular. And what I also think Keith's articles point out very clear, this is not a Republican issue or Democratic issue. It has been a bipartisan accumulation of this gap, and it's going to take that approach, realizing that for people who are elected, it's going to come at the cost of losing some elections in order to make those structural reforms.
Colin?
I guess the last thing that I would say about this particular part of the topic is one of the illusions that we labor under, at least I think it's an illusion, is that Dan Malloy wasn't a reform governor, but in ways that Keith has suggested, he kind of was a reform governor. And so in other words, he tackled a lot of the problems that people think of when they think about ways in which the state is in fiscal dysfunction. He cut the size of the workforce by thousands and thousands of full-time positions, and not all of them at the entry-level bottom of the rung either. He has begun transitioning the workforce, new hires, into a defined contribution type of pension plan as opposed to the defined benefit plan that makes everybody so mad. So, I mean, he's done a lot of the things that you would do, the low-hanging fruit and maybe even the medium-high-hanging fruit that you would do if you were a reform governor. If you were planning on getting some new 2019 sworn-in reform governor in there, boy, a lot of the stuff that person would do has already been done. And in all the ways that Keith says, the problems aren't fixed because the problems are deeper and longer and bigger. I do feel as though Lamont's moves are going to have to be different from the ones that a lot of people out there assume have never been made. In fact, a lot of the things, if you're sort of a grumpy Connecticut resident who basically thinks for the last 8 years we've done nothing about the state's fiscal crisis, well, a lot of the stuff that you would do if I handed you a magic wand already got done by Malloy.
Yeah, if you think of how you would address income or wealth inequality, the first thing we might think of is, okay, how can we redistribute burdens in the context of a situation where government seems to have its ducks in a row? That's what you'd be talking. But in the Connecticut context, it's if you look at the math for the pension debt, the assumption is we owe so much money over the next 15 years, every single person in Connecticut has to sacrifice. Everybody's going to end up paying more in taxes and getting less services. That's our baseline. And then we talk about from that baseline that people haven't even understood yet, how do we redistribute services? That's the ugly thing. Again, we're talking about. So some people say some folks should lose nothing. They're just – it's just so in trouble and it puts the economy at risk. So fine. So if I can't touch, say, the poorest, now I have to go to the remaining groups and get even more. And then to get politicians ready to have a candid discussion with this type of context – we've got people running for governor talking about eliminating the income tax. I mean, there's not even close to.
But as we've also found, Keith, if we do shift those burdens to the wealthiest Connecticut residents, as we saw during the last economic downturn, and who knows if we got another recession coming on the horizon, our ability to count on those revenues moving forward, it's really up in the air. It's the most volatile source of income if we put more on the income side of the wealthiest people in the state.
We are like somebody, though, who's on the way to the dentist and insisting upon a positive root canal experience. You hope the dentist has skills. You hope the chair is comfortable. You hope he or she uses sufficient Novocaine. But you're standing outside the – not you, John, but we're standing outside the office going, no, until you can show me how I'm going to love this experience – there is no scenario that does that because of the amount of debt Connecticut has amassed over the last 70 years.
I hate to end the segment with one other little piece of bad news, Kalila, but something else just came out from the federal government. Connecticut experienced a nearly 17.5% increase in homelessness between 2017 and 2018. That's according to a federal report released this week. And that means that there are fewer people able to find shelter. It means that the price of living in a house or a rental property anywhere in the state is too high for the amount of money that people are making. And that's something to really pay attention to.
Happy holidays. We're just so great and pleasant this morning, right? But I think it also, again, speaks to how instability in one sector affects so many other pieces, that if you have more families who are housing insecure, it's going to have an effect on the stability of their kids in school, because then the towns have to figure out if a child is in a shelter or temporary housing in another town, how do we get them to school? We see higher rates of truancy and absence, and that has lifetime effects on earning potential as well. Last thing I'll say is it's clear this is a structural problem that will not be solved by a quick fix. And I hear so many people saying, well, the answer is marijuana legalization or the answer is casinos. That will not fix the depth of this problem that we're in. And people have to take a long range view of getting out of this issue.
Did you want to have a quick last thing?
Yeah, I know we're pressed for time. I should have mentioned one of the most important things about wealth and income migration is that that is not the primary means by which the state gets more or less affluent. More than anything else we found, there is not a lot of migration. Arkansas has been gaining income for the last 30 years. And on all the poverty metrics, it's still one of the poorest states in the nation. Connecticut's been losing income for the last 30 years, and so is Maryland and all the other states
so
at the top of the rank. Correct. And they're still among the richest states per capita in the nation.
And Colin, that's a very important thing that, again, sort of gets lost when we campaign about this being a problem that's actually not a problem compared to the rest of the country.
Right. And it's another reason why you should read Keith's article, the Millionaire with a Suitcase article in particular, I think looks at this in a really, really balanced way. It tends to get described in pretty stark, one-sided terms, one side or the other. Just quickly about housing. This is another reason why Melissa McCaw is going to be an interesting budget director, because she's been working in Hartford for a really long time. She knows firsthand, close up, what it looks like when you don't distribute housing across the state in anything resembling an even-handed way, but when you warehouse the poor in cities which have shrinking tax bases because of all their tax-exempt property, she will be in a very good position to communicate about some of the problems that we have with housing. Talk about a need we didn't address for decades.
Well, when we come back, let's talk about her and some other hires that Ned Lamont is making and some other people who are making recommendations to tackle some of the things that we are talking about today. That's Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. You just also heard from Keith Faniff. He's state budget guru from the Connecticut Mirror. You can read these articles at ctmirror.org. And Kalila Brown-Dean is here. She's associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. We're in the wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation today on Facebook Live, among other places, at WNPR Wheelhouse. We're joined by Keith Vaniff. He's the state budget guru of the Connecticut Mirror. You can read the articles that we've been talking about at ctmirror.org. Kalila Brown-Dean is here from Quinnipiac University, as well as our own Colin McEnroe. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
First of all, I want to say namaste, Keith.
Yes.
every year we do this, and
I got nothing.
every year we do this. We bring in some jazz aficionados, specifically the two fabulous jazz pianists, Jen Allen and Noah Behrman, and jazz critic and savant Gene Seymour, just to talk about some of the best recorded jazz of the year. We're going to play a lot of music for you, talk to them about why they think these particular cuts stand out.
And I will be listening along because I'm a big jazz fan, maybe throwing in some suggestions on Twitter. A good show today at 1 o'clock. Over the weekend, Governor-elect Ned Lamont appeared on our friend Max Reese's NBC Connecticut Face the Facts show, and he was asked this question by Max.
What does Connecticut look like, do you think, 5 years from now, socially, politically, fiscally, 4 or 5 years from now after the first term of Governor-elect Ned Lamont?
We've got our fiscal house in order. And we're now able to invest in our future again, invest in transportation, invest in our schools. We have great community colleges that are training people for the jobs at Pratt and Electric Boat and nursing and education. And young people are coming back to the state of Connecticut again. I want to do everything I can to attract young people here. Say this is a place you can start a business and start a family, just like it was for Annie and I when we were here 40 years ago.
In a minute, I want to get to Keith, who may say that it's not realistic for that to happen in 4 or 5 years. Colin, a quick reaction to Ned Lamont's vision?
First of all, he does not do Ned Lamont as well as you do, Ned Lamont.
I can't do it with my voice like this right now.
But first of all, it's so early to be hazarding guesses about what sort of governor Ned Lamont is going to be. I mean, he's assembling a staff right now. That staff, that executive branch will begin interacting with a legislative branch, which has also been significantly reshaped during the offseason. There's going to be a lot of new faces up there, a lot of new power brokers up there. So it's very, very early to say very much about this. But I will say this, that, you know, I mean, in a way, we went through what seemed like a lackluster campaign where I think a lot of people thought that there weren't really any good choices among the three candidates, that they weren't that excited about anybody. You know, nobody seemed to have a real vision that made any sense. You know, Mario Cuomo said that people campaign in poetry and govern in prose. Ned has never been particularly good at the poetry part of this. He's not a particularly stirring campaigner. He's the guy you just heard talking to Max right there. I wouldn't be surprised, though, and his early moves suggest this, that if in a very methodical, conscientious way, because I think that is who he is, he really started working hard to address some of these problems. As I said in the previous segment, he can't be a sweeping reform governor because there aren't the resources to reform stuff. And also, Malloy really picked a lot of that fruit. This is, I think, a lot of his job is going to be, you know, nipping, tucking, implementing maybe changes that nobody's really seen, looking for some efficiencies and opportunities that nobody really spotted before. But don't be surprised if he's actually pretty good at this stuff.
Kalila?
Yeah, I think we have to. So that was a very ambitious agenda that he set forth in that very short clip. And to think that all of that can be done in 4 to 5 years, again, is incredibly ambitious. But I think it also shows us what happens when you have someone become governor who is not your standard politician. Because the standard politician would have been very conservative in what they put forth in the 4 to 5 years. They would have emphasized those smaller kinds of changes around the margins. And I think it's good that Lamont is ambitious, but what I think is even better is that he's acknowledging what he does and what he doesn't know. And he's bringing in people to give suggestions, to offer policy recommendations, and to staff his office who can help address those blind spots to actually get things done. Whether what can be done is different from what voters and the public is demanding, we already know that's going to be the real challenge of governing.
I want to ask about some of the people he's brought into the office. But first, Keith, when he talks about 4 or 5 years down the road, that's the vision of what it looks like. Do you think he can get there?
No.
That's why I came to you last.
If my life has a meaning, it's summed up in this one sentence. Numbers don't care about political will. It's no disrespect to Governor-elect Lamont, so let me expand my no. Nobody can get us there in 4 to 5 years, and our fiscal house is not in order now, and it probably won't be completely in order 10 years from now, and that's not about being depressing, and that's not about being negative. That's simply acknowledging the math. When I hurt my knee and I had to go into physical therapy, I had to lay on the ground and do these really painful stretches. And while I was doing them, because I'm so uncoordinated, I tore a muscle in my back. And then I had to slow the physical therapy down and just let my back heal. And I wanted to do other things, but as they've told me in therapy, welcome to the land of you don't have a choice. Connecticut is grappling with too many problems at once, and it will be a long, slow crawl, and nothing's going to change it. But we get jazz music later today, so it balances off.
So the depressing isn't what you are trying to do. That's just a little bonus for us at the holiday season.
It is what it is. Mm. Numbers don't care about political will.
What about the people he's brought in? We've talked already about Melissa McCaw. He's shifting around the structure of the office a little bit, bringing in a guy who knows politics really well, Paul Mounds, a guy that we know who's worked both at the federal level and at the state level and at the city level. What do you think about these hires and what they can do to help him in this, you know, transition period and maybe this kind of bleak period that you're outlining?
I think what's very interesting is a lot of legislators are going to be watching to see not just about they're not going to be watching to see the competence of Melissa McCaw or Paul Mounds because they already know the competence is there. People know that we're talking about very bright individuals. Nobody's worried about that. They're curious to see how loud of a voice they're going to have in the back room driving the agenda. If Melissa McCaw is told, this is Governor Lamont's vision, execute it. She can do that. If she has a role in shaping that vision, I think legislators are going to be happier.
Mm. Kalala?
Yeah, and I think we often leave out the piece of legislators because they are bringing a very diverse agenda, very divided agenda, and it's going to mean something now that the players at the state legislature have changed and reordered power structures there as they deal with their own kind of battle. So the pressure that they are going to bring, the pressure of the national political scene, and how that may create some imperatives here in Connecticut, that whether Lamont is ready to address them or wants to address them, he can't avoid them. And so looking in that way, I think it's even more complicated as a political space.
Right. So, I mean, some of this, once again, it's very early to say what all this stuff means. I mean, we get names and titles. We don't really know how they play out until we watch the team take the field. And so, I mean, just to sort of maybe even clarify something that you said in terms of reordering or reshaping government. So Paul Mounds, who by the way, every time I read that he's 33, I can't really figure that out because I feel like I've known Paul for 33 years or something, and he wasn't a baby when I met him. But anyway, Paul Mounds, who's a guy, as you say, a lot of experience and also sort of a face that you're happy to see. You people like Paul Mounds. You know, you meet him in the hallway, you're glad you ran into him. There are people who've done that job or a job like that where you'd go way out of your way. You take a route way out of your way to not run into that person. Okay, Paul is not that guy. He's been brought into COO. This is sort of a term that doesn't really have any particular meaning in state government and the governor's office. It's I think something closer to what John Rowland referred to as co-chiefs of staff. Rowland often had two chiefs of staff. One for the legal business, one for the illegal business. No, that's not what it was. But you know, so
we kid.
How this all gets set up? I think the guy who's got the job of chief of staff, who's a Bridgewater hedge fund guy, you know, he's going to have one set of duties. Paul, I think, is probably going to interact a lot more with other elected officials. He knows that territory pretty well. But, I mean, until they really get on the field, and as Keith said, too, a very important question is, are they just executing thoughts that come from the brain of Ned Lamont, or are they part of the brain of Ned Lamont? And that's another thing we don't know yet.
All the recommendations that come into the governor's office aren't going to be coming from the people we just talked about or any of the other people that he's hiring. The transition team created a series of advisory committees to help set policy goals for the first 100 days. Kalila Brown-Dean actually served on one of these committees, and both as a point of disclosure, but also because you know a little something about this. This is the Women's Policy Committee for this transition team. What sort of things are you talking about? And maybe as you talk about the goals, weave them into this bigger issue and this problem that Keith's talking about, because we've got a lot of policy goals that we all want to reach, but there's the bigger problem that we're all facing.
Right. And so I think it was very clear for our committee on women and girls, but all of the committees, to understand that there are, as Keith would say, these numerical constraints on what can be done, when it can be done, and for whom it can be done. So one of the things that we looked at on the Women's Policy Committee was, what are the disparities in our state? And how can addressing those disparities do things like grow our economy, make our state more attractive for businesses, make it more solvent for families, and keep young people here? So as an example, we talked about the disproportionate rates of punishment for girls of color within Connecticut school systems. When you look at the very high expulsion and suspension rates of girls of color in our state, that's something that can be addressed, that is revenue neutral, but addresses some of these broader institutional things that can happen. And what I most appreciated about this, this was a nonpartisan commitment. So you had people coming together across the political aisle, across issues and ideologies to say, what do we do to make our state better? And I have to give a shout out to the students of Grace Academy in Hartford, because those young students, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh grade, asked tough questions, but presented themselves in a way that shows what can happen when you invest in the success of girls and women across our state.
Keith, what do you see in some of the policies, policy ideas that are coming out of this committee, other committees, the things that are bubbling up to the governor-elect? Because each transition of a new governor, we have a lot of people who are stressing, these are the things that we want to have done. What do you see in all this?
Honestly, I'm going to stick with my theme here. I see a lot of danger, because it's the danger of setting false expectations. When Governor-elect Lamont comes out and says, we've got our fiscal house in order, it shouldn't be a surprise that these policy groups start bringing up new initiatives. That's what you do when you have your fiscal house in order. Well, we still have some needs that aren't met. And you go forward until mid-February comes up and his budget comes out, and it's going to be the biggest splash of cold water in Connecticut's face. And people are going to basically say, what the bleep? I thought we were getting in a position where we could do X and Y and Z, and we're talking about trimming these areas? Why am I not seeing this? I thought our fiscal house was in order. It reminds me very much like Governor Malloy's start of his second term. He campaigns, pledged not to raise taxes. There's not even a deficit. We're actually going to be cutting taxes after the election. After the election, we hear state of permanent fiscal crisis. We're raising taxes, not the second largest in state history, but a big tax increase. And GE and Aetna and other companies say, what the heck? If it's not about being negative, but if you don't set the context properly, you erode public trust.
What about the battle it sets up amongst social service agencies on the private side and on the public side? Both sides say they're the ways to actually provide the services with diminishing funds, obviously,
right,
over the course of the next couple of years. How do you think that battle plays out?
And that I will tell you how that battle plays out. And that's an example of how you don't have your fiscal house in order, because as you just pointed out, John, it's a battle between union and the private sector for scarce resources. That's what happens when things are a mess. I think the way it plays out is inevitably the state moves toward privatization, but probably not for at least a couple of years because of the concessions deal. Unfortunately, I think it's a move toward privatization, sticking with the depressing theme for Colin, where we put more burdens on private nonprofit social services, but don't give them more resources.
Mm. Colin?
All of that has already happened, essentially. First of all, there was a huge
gets worse.
Yeah. So there was a huge privatization push under Roland in particular, and certainly also under Malloy, where there was the cutting of the resources that were going to go to the nonprofit sector. They'd be happy to tell you that they're being asked to do more with fewer resources. So, yeah, that's already happening. And I want to say that this is an area where I'm increasingly kind of agnostic. I used to think I had kind of a handle on the question of who delivers services better and who delivers what kind of services better and what kinds of things should stay with kind of tenured state employees, you know, who have a certain core competency and some expertise and stuff like that. And then, you know, because a lot of times when you privatize something, you know, if you privatize, for example, tax collection, which a lot of cities do, you suddenly have nobody at City Hall who can deal with a problem that a taxpayer is having, because all the decisions are being made at some company somewhere. So there are ways in which privatization is not always a good thing. And I think I'm a little bit more comfortable right now saying I'm not quite sure exactly how to make those kinds of discernments. But I think Keith is right. It probably is a year or two because of the freeze and layoffs and stuff like that, you know, and the need to – they're going to just have to maintain a certain personnel level. I'm not sure privatization is the big push right away.
I know that these are all the big problems that seem very, very daunting. And Keith has depressed us in front of the holiday season. I will say a couple quick things, though, to bring to your attention. Ned Lamont has said he promises to be a criminal justice reformer, to stay with some of the changes that Governor Malloy has made. We also have news yesterday that Connecticut, along with eight other states and Washington, D.C., announced that they're going to join to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, kind of like a Reggie for transit, the idea that we're going to really cut carbon emissions within this corridor. So these are a couple things that do have, like, as they say, a fiscal note attached. Mm-hmm. It's going to cost some money to do that, but seem to signal ways in which this new governor might be moving in directions to move us forward, I suppose, even while we've got the other problems about how we're going to pay for everything.
Right. So I have to say, Keith, I think you're probably going to be fantastic at a dinner party this holiday season. I can't wait.
Time to clear the room. Bring it, Keith.
Here comes Keith. But it raises the question of what do we do? So if we constantly sit in the notion of things are fiscally horrible and they're not going to get any better, then what do we do as residents of this state? And so I think there are changes that can be made, not just about, you know, sort of inspiring people in some hokey way, but of realizing that things have to continue, life has to continue, and people have to get involved in that. And so to say that criminal justice reform is a way, cutting these emissions is a way to move forward, that's an investment in our future. And everyone knows you have to spend money in order to make money. So if that's the investment that we are going to make, that we prioritize, because we realize that being smarter on crime saves us money in the long run, reduces the burden on cities who have to deal with high-cost citizens, that's something that I think we should prioritize.
We're going to take a break. Here. When we come back, we'll have some airing of grievances, some feats of strength around the Festivus holiday season. Kalila Brown-Dean is here from Quinnipiac University, Keith Vanna from the Connecticut Mirror, and also our own Colin McEnroe. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Keith Vanna from the Connecticut Mirror, Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, and our own Colin McEnroe. We've got a lot still to get to in the last couple of minutes, but I want to bring up this story, Colin. UConn and its former men's basketball coach Kevin Ollie are at odds. The latest is Ollie wants to bring a federal discrimination claim against the university. He alleges that it's illegally preventing him from doing so. This stems from the firing of Kevin Ollie amidst some recruiting violation allegations. He says, basically, Jim Calhoun for years did some of the same stuff, and you didn't ever fire him, and the university is trying to keep Kevin Ollie from actually filing the suit.
Well, he's certainly not wrong in his first point there. So Jim Calhoun's offenses were considerable. He was suspended for three games as a result of illegalities and improper activities in the Nate Miles recruitment courtship. Other members of his staff, I believe, were just cashiered. I mean, they kind of lost their jobs. And also, so the program was put on probation until 2014 because of that offense. But the team also had a 2013 postseason ban because of academic record problems. So, I mean, Calhoun had, you know, way, way, way more problems than anything that's ever been illustrated about Kevin Ollie. In terms of the merits of this suit, I'm not a good enough lawyer. I haven't read enough about it. If I were UConn, I would be nervous about the discovery process, what kind of emails, what kinds of meeting notes memorializing certain conversations you have had. People tend to be very sloppy about that. I would be very surprised if UConn and the people who are decision makers out there haven't been somewhat sloppy about that. So there may be a big impulse to settle rather than go through discovery.
Yeah, and to settle, and just very quickly, Kalila, once again, maybe settling State University, talking gigantic contracts. We hand out multi-million dollar contracts to coaches all the time, and here's more taxpayer money at risk.
Right. This is our priority, to pay very high salaries, very high court costs for coaches and for their staff. I don't fault Kevin Ollie for filing this suit or for, you know, making this complaint. That's certainly his right. What I do fault is an institutional structure that prioritizes college sports over the well-being of its students. Because when these things happen, the people who lose out are the students and their families who, many of them, this is their only way to get a higher education degree and now have to deal with the fallout of their school's bad decisions.
We've been ending our program, Keith, with airing of grievances or feats of strength.
And we'd like to aired enough grievances already?
We'd like to go to you. I would love it if you had a feat of strength, Keith, but go ahead.
I don't have a grievance to air. I don't know if this even qualifies as a feat of strength. Yeah. I've just realized something over the last year. There's no problem that's so bad that it can't be made better by looking at pictures of dogs and cats messing with each other on Twitter. If more people did that, this world would be a better place. I watched one cat for no reason at all, sitting on a mirror on a refrigerator with another, push the cat off. His another cat right next to him just shoved him off out of the blue. I must have watched it 25 times yesterday. I think every problem went away.
And that's also a metaphor for the state's fiscal crisis that I'm sure you can work in somewhere.
I guarantee
cat pushing the other cat.
Right now, if Governor-elect Lamont was looking at a cat swiping at a dog, maybe riding a Roomba while doing it, he would have all the problems to the budget solved.
All would be better. How about you, Kalila?
I actually have a grievance. So yeah. We know that the Senate last night passed this First Step Act, which is meant to reform the criminal justice system at the federal level. Less than 200,000 inmates at the federal level, over 2 million at local and state. And so while we should applaud that reform, we have to also remember that President Trump has put forth William Barr as his nominee to replace Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, who, when he was previously the Attorney General, made the case for more incarceration that devastated the communities. So looking at that in the totality and also looking at the case of Santoya Brown in Tennessee, sentenced to 51 years for killing her attacker when she was a victim of sex trafficking.
Very serious grievances. Thank you, Kalila. Colin, how about you?
I was going to do a grievance, but I'm going to do a feat of strength because I think we need one after this show. I think it's good to look at businesses that are starting up around here, you know, just by just regular old people doing something really cool. And I'm going to single out a company called Amazing Aki. So these are Jamaican patties. They're vegan Jamaican patties. Vegan aki is this kind of, it's sort of the other magical Jamaican substance. It's hard to even explain what it tastes like. It sort of tastes like scrambled eggs or something. Anyway, they do a whole bunch of different kinds of vegan patties. They operate out of just a little bit north of Hartford. They're either in Bloomfield or Windsor. You can buy the patties at Geisler's in Windsor, or Geisler's supermarket in Bloomfield. They sell them at The Bean, which is a coffee shop in Windsor. I've been getting them at the Coventry Winter Farmers Market, where I'm there with my Jamaica file friends, James and Norman. We're all very excited. They're so delicious. They're really good. And they have kind of a lightness to them that you often don't get with the Jamaican patties. There's a light fluffiness to it. Yeah, I believe the chef is, I think her name is Chantal Thomas. But anyway, terrific. Amazing Aki. And you can look them up on the line. That's online. That's their name, amazingaki.com.
Very nice. I love that. And I like that they're a little bit lighter.
Yes. Because they are lighter.
The Jamaican patty can be a day ender if you have
right.
a heavy
one
in the middle
of the
day.
You can play hockey with some of those.
Okay. So speaking of hockey, I'm going to get to that in just one moment. First of all, my feat of strength. Howard Berkus is a reporter for NPR who many of you know. He's been working for years, not only with PBS Frontline, other reporters at NPR, and also a group called Ohio Valley Resource, which is a collaborative journalism network very much like the one that I run. And they've been working on the story of black lung amongst miners in Appalachia. Kalila's from Virginia. I'm from Pennsylvania. We're on the far reaches of this Appalachian coal belt that has been in the news because Donald Trump's wanted to bring jobs back there. The problem is those jobs over the course of the last several decades have been killing people. And the federal government and the state governments and local governments haven't been paying anywhere near enough attention to just how many people are sickened by black lung disease. This latest in a series of reports shows just how much they have been off. It also shows the problem of silica, which is another type of dust, which it happens when you're mining in places where there's not that much coal, but you're just going for the last little seam, and that ends up in the lungs of people. It's like shards of glass. And I encourage you to read this reporting. It doesn't sound like a cheery thing or a feat of strength, Kalila, but I will say it is a really, really important story for people from where we're from. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to end with a gripe, and it's a gripe that a lot of you might already have. This upcoming weekend on December 23rd, the Carolina Hurricanes, remember them? They're a hockey team that used to be called the Whalers, and they moved there some years ago. They actually won a Stanley Cup. In 1997, they left this city high and dry, and now the Carolina Hurricanes, somewhat struggling with attendance, trying to sell more merchandise, have brought back the Hartford Whalers' original uniforms, and they are going to be performing as the Hartford Whalers on December 23rd. Cue the music, Kayum. I will just say that as much as I love the Peter Good designed uniforms, as much as I love the logo, I think many of us share the idea that they shouldn't be wearing them, Colin, in Carolina. They should be only wearing them here in Hartford.
Traitors! Traitors! By the way, the story behind this song is a story we should tell on the show someday.
the story behind Brass Bonanza. Yes, this is the Hartford Whalers theme song. I will hold you to that, Colin. Yeah. Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show. Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University. Thank you, Kalila, and Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you.
And thank you also to Keith Faniff, our budget guru from the Connecticut Mirror. Thank you so much, and happy holidays, Keith.
Smiles and puppies.
Smiles and puppies. The Wheelhouse is produced by Scott Brady. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. Kyle Wolf is the technical producer. Happy holidays to all of you. We'll be off next week.